uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And a beautiful Thursday to you. Greetings, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live all across the United States on the 10th of March. A beautiful sunny day here in the Northeast. Strange weather, I understand, traveling across the Midwest. Thomas.loc.gov. The things you learn. I am just so blessed doing this program with having one of the most intelligent listener bases out there. We had somebody who called and asked about Thomas, which is named after Thomas Jefferson, which is this Library of Congress program, it turns out, to let we the people know what bills are before Congress and who's doing what and all that kind of stuff. And yesterday I pointed out that the website was thomas.loc.gov, but I didn't know what LOC stood for. So somebody sent me a note, Jim, actually. He doesn't say where he is. And he says, LOC in thomas.loc.gov stands for Library of Congress. Well, okay, of course. Thanks for the forehead slap. And I appreciate that, Jim. Great to hear from you. Our questions for the day, are the Dems going to out each other? Number one. Is, in our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment today, we'll be asking the question, is somebody murdering people investigating voter fraud? Wait till we get to that. And, of course, the best of the rest of the news, lots of interesting and fascinating things. Here, to start out, though, with the Democrats outing each other, I am so disappointed, I have to say, in a couple of senators who voted to allow the bankruptcy bill to come to the floor. And I have to find out from these people why. Why did they vote for this? Joe Lieberman, that makes sense. The guy's he's more right-wing than Olympia Snow, who's a Republican. But Senator Byrd of West Virginia, why did he vote for this? Joe Biden wants to be president. He says he wants to defend we the people. Why did he vote for this rotten, corrupt bankruptcy bill? Debbie Stabenow, Michigan, why did she vote for it? If anybody knows the answer to any of these questions, I would love to know, because I am not seeing any explanations anywhere for why these people voted. And I would hate to think, as some are asserting, that it simply is money speaking. In fact, I got an email this morning. Democratic senators who will never be president have voted to let the rotten bankruptcy bill come to the floor where it will pass. And it, you know, without these Democratic senators, this may not have happened. Joe Biden, well, here, I just the last names. Biden, Byrd of West Virginia, Carper of Delaware, Conrad of North Dakota, Johnson of South Dakota, Cole of Wisconsin, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, Lieberman of Connecticut, Lincoln of Arkansas, Nelson of Florida, Nelson of Nebraska, Pryor of Arkansas, Salazar of Colorado, and Stabenow of Michigan. Why? Why did you vote for this thing? Now, on the House side, we have a little more information about the Democrats who voted for it. There is this new Democrat coalition. This is the ongoing birthing, actually I'd say dying, of the Democratic Leadership Council, this thing that Bill Clinton put together. Let's turn the Democratic Party into Republican light, and let's get into bed with some of the corporations, and let's get some of their money, and with that money we'll then be able to run ads, and we'll be able to win, you know, because that 1978 Supreme Court decision, First National Bank of Boston versus Massachusetts Attorney General Frank Bellotti, Boston versus Bellotti, in 1978 basically said, okay, a corporation is a person. They have rights of free speech. And because they don't have a mouth, their organ of speech is money. And this was an outrageous Supreme Court decision, a 5-4 decision. In fact, Rehnquist voted against it. Go figure. And that decision, and those of you who are old enough to remember what politics was like before 78, basically 1980. It took a year or two, you know, it took an election cycle for it to filter in, to set in, for people to figure out what was going on. And 1980, the first really corrupt year of politics in the modern era, let's say, in terms of corporate corruption of the political process with money. And within 10 years, you know, by the early 90s, you had folks like John McCain on the Republican side and Ted Kennedy on the Democratic side saying, you know, we need Russ Feingold. In fact, it was McCain-Feingold. We need to do something about this. We need to reform. We've got to get all this corporate money out of here because we no longer have politics. We no longer have government of, by, and for we the people. Instead, we have government of, by, and for the wealthiest corporations, and their interests and their interests alone are being represented. And that's not what the founders had in mind. That's not what you call democracy in a constitutionally limited republic. That's called oligarchy, actually, if you want to get very technical. Oligarchs are, you know, when you have a small number of wealthy families who basically own a country, that's called an oligarchy. Well, instead of families, they're corporations, but what's the difference? So in the House, they actually went on the record. And maybe these senators did, too. I don't, and I just couldn't find it. But in the House, it's just, they're just right up front about it here. The House, this is from David Sirota of American Progress, Center for American Progress. The House New Democrat Coalition issued a letter demanding passage of the credit card commercial bank backed bankruptcy bill. This letter undermines efforts of other Democrats in the House and Senate to stop passage of the bill. And then let's see who signed this letter. By the way, the letter. With consumer debt reaching record highs of more than $2 trillion, members of the New Democrat Coalition, NDC, sent a letter today to Speaker Dennis Hastert urging him to schedule House action on the bankruptcy reform legislation as soon as the Senate completes its consideration of the bill. The letter, signed by 20 NDC members, including the four NDC leaders. These are the people, you know, if the Democrats are going to clean house, this is where it should begin, is with getting these people out of office. If they really want to represent we the people. The letter signed by 20, and I'll give you the names in just a minute. The letter signed by 20 NDC members, including four NDC leaders, reiterates New Democrats' longstanding support for common sense bankruptcy legislation and states an intention to work across the aisle to pass bankruptcy reform into law. You know, this law that we're talking about sustains and maintains a huge loophole for rich folks who can, for billionaires, multimillionaires and billionaires, who can create asset protection trusts. So if Ken Lay wants to declare bankruptcy, he can still stash aside, you know, 10, 20, 30, 100 million bucks, whatever. But if somebody who's only making $40,000, $50,000 a year, $20,000 a year, $5,000 a year, even maybe $100,000 a year, they can't do that. And they get hit with medical bills. And Ted Kennedy tried to put in a provision that says, you know, if somebody's wiped out because of medical bills, which is more than half of all bankruptcies in America right now, that they would be able to declare, they would have some bankruptcy. No, forget it, the Republicans said. And the New Democrats. And several of the Democrats put forward, you know, amendments to this thing that would say, okay, if you're in the military, if you're one of these National Guard guys who got called up and you came back and your job is gone, or you haven't, you know, haven't had an income, or you ran your own small business and say you're a CPA or something like that, and you're gone for a year and a half in Iraq, you come back, all your customers have found somebody else. People can't wait around a year and a half for their CPA to do their taxes. They'd go to jail. So who are these New Democrats? And what did they get out of this? Well, Representative Ellen O. Tauscher got $20,500 from commercial banks. Representative Adam Smith got $18,000 from commercial banks. I got to tell you, as prostitutes, these members of Congress are pretty damn cheap, as in inexpensive. Representative Ron Kind, or is it kind? I'm not sure. 24,300 from commercial banks. Representative Artur Davis, $68,999 from commercial banks. Representative Carolyn McCarthy, $24,200 from commercial banks, $17,500 from finance and credit card companies. Representative Dennis Moore, $62,500 from commercial banks, $33,000 from finance credit card companies. Representative Mike McIntyre, $18,500 from commercial banks. Now, you expect this from the Republicans. They are all in the pockets of these corporations. But here you've got Democrats who are actually proud of it. Representative Joe Crowley, $63,700 from commercial banks, $34,500 from finance credit card companies. Representative Steve Israel, $44,229 from commercial banks. Representative David Wu, $46,050 from commercial banks. Representative Darlene Hooley, $54,500 from commercial banks, $27,750 from finance and credit card companies. Representative Melissa Bean, $21,500 from commercial banks. Representative Jim Davis, $17,250 from commercial banks. Congressman Representative Harold E. Ford, Jr. I thought he was a decent guy. I've seen him on Crossfire a lot. You know, he does pretty good. So $87,130 from commercial banks, $30,000 from finance and credit card companies. Signed a letter saying, pass the bankruptcy. You know, the screw the average person bill. Representative Ed Case, $12,650 from commercial banks. Representative Gregory W. Meeks, $26,250 from commercial banks. Incredible. And you probably will not hear this rant, by the way. You certainly won't hear it on right-wing talk show programs where, you know, because this is just fine with them. And in fact, you know, as I said, the Republicans are in bed on this thing as well. And it'll be interesting to find out to see what progressive talk show hosts discuss these things. This is a sellout of the American people, and it's a sellout that is happening. This is a cancer within the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party is not going to stand on its own 2 feet, and they're not going to get we, the people of the United States, back on their side until they start standing up for us. And when you've got groups like this New Democratic, what is it, coalition, do they call themselves? Yeah, New Democratic Coalition, New Democrat Coalition. They even call them Democratic. New Democrat Coalition saying, yeah, let's do what the banks want. Let's just, you know. I'm sorry, guys, you've lost me. You have lost me. 1-866-889-8894, by the way, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into the chat room. Tom Hartman here with you, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Close your eyes. Close the door. You don't have to worry anymore.
Hi, Els. Welcome back.
I'll be your baby tonight.
That's for you, Louise. Welcome back, my friends. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. As somebody in the chat room, it's scrolled up here. I missed who. Anyhow, somebody in the chat room asked, where did you get those statistics? Where did you get that information? I got it from an email I received from David Sirota. I'm assuming this is on their website, AmericanProgress.org. And he says, the House Democrats who signed the letter pocketed a combined $750,000 in their two-year campaigns for Congress in 2004. To put that in perspective, that's the equivalent of the industry giving these members $1,000 every single day of the last 2 years. $1,000 a day for 2 years, you got your vote. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Mike from the black hole of the belly of the beast. Is that Washington, D.C., Mike?
Yes, sir.
Aha. Welcome.
How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I'm not so great. I hate to say it, but the Democratic Party is dead, dead, dead. Stick a fork in it, it's done.
Well, you know, if Howard Dean hadn't been elected head of the DNC, I would tend to agree with you. I would say the Democratic Leadership Council and these new Democrats, in my opinion, are dead, dead, dead. My hope is that the Democratic Party can revive itself. It's on life support, but it has the potential to revive itself, in my opinion.
Well, I don't know. They've been selling us out for a long time anyway, at least since Clinton decided that he was going to jettison the traditional force of the Democratic Party and buy into the let's be as Republican as we can.
Right. This is when it began, basically right around 1990. And the reason why, though, I mean, let's cut the guy a little slack here, Mike. We both need to acknowledge that when Reagan declared war on organized labor back in 1980 and took us from 12% unionized or 25% unionized workforce in the United States down to 7.9% right now in the private workforce, that half of the reason why they did that, I mean, there was the philosophical half that they didn't think that workers should have any rights, but the other half of it was they wanted to cut all the funding source for the Democratic Party. And so Clinton's looking around going, gee, I'd like to run for president. Where am I going to get any money? And the only thing he could come up with, this was pre-internet. I mean, you know, the internet was out there, but nobody had proven that you could do anything with it in terms of money. The only thing he could come up with was, well, the corporations are where all the money is, so let's go hang out with the corporations. And that's what they did. And I agree with you. It was a sellout. And there's a whole bunch of them that are still doing it. And it's time for us to say, you know, fortunately, Bernie Sanders is my congressman here in Vermont. He's an independent. He's not part of this bunch, and he wouldn't go along with them. But it's time for those of us who live in states where these so-called new Democrats are representing us to get involved in the primary process and get them out of there and get a decent Democrat elected or, you know, a Green or something else, anything.
Yeah, but to show you how far the political process and both parties have fallen, think about this. We used to have a man in the a senator who was a Republican. His name was Everett Dirksen. The man was a statesman.
Oh, I remember Everett Dirksen quite well with his extraordinary deep voice. He had a Darth Vader voice. It was even deeper than Darth Vader. He had a wonderful
great
voice.
Man. I mean, yeah. I met him personally.
Yeah.
Wonderful person, just as Bobby Kennedy was. Met him too. Now look what we have.
I know. Well, there's still a few statesmen out there, Mike. There really are. And there are still a few people who are, you know, truly people of goodwill and truly representing us and really working at it very hard. And we need to be encouraging them. I just don't think these broad brush swipes. That's why I'm naming names. You know, we're taking names and kicking butt here. I'm going to name names and amounts rather than just, you know, I'm not up for attacking the Democratic Party because I think that there's hope there. And I'm very hopeful, frankly. And as I said, I see the election of Howard Dean is a great sign. Mike, I appreciate the call. Great to hear from you. The bottom line is if we don't get active, Mike and any everybody else listening, if you and I don't get active and do something about this, you know, volunteer for the local Democratic Party. Become the party. Infiltrate it and take it over. And the Republican Party, too. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I said, hold it, Doc. A world war passed through my brain. He said, nurse, get your pad. The boy's obviously insane. He grabbed my arm, and I said, ouch, as I landed on the psychiatric couch. He said, tell me about it, your dream.
Yes, well, I got this dream about America, you see. Democracy. Our congressmen and congresswomen and senators actually acting on our behalf instead of on the behalf of MBNA or something. Gandolfi in the chat room says, Tom, I go to my local Dem party sometimes, and it seems brain dead. There are limits to how much one can do. Well, I know what you mean. And it won't be brain dead if you get involved. If you go and say, listen, I'm here. I'm volunteering. I'm going to run for something. Run for school board. Run for dog catcher. Bring your brain along. If your local Democratic Party is brain dead, give them a brain transfusion. Get five friends to go with you. Organize a conspiracy. It's the conspiracy of the radical middle. We're going to take back our nation. See, it's not that difficult. And I'll tell you, it's actually happening. So get active. Get active. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com, the website if you want to drop into the chat room. Bill in Santa Fe on the line. Hey, Bill, you listening to us on KRSN?
It's 1490.
Right, yeah, great.
Wonderful. Right on time. You give us hope. That's why I like you so much.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you got to turn your radio down there because there's a five-second delay, Bill.
Yeah, sorry. It seems to me that one of the big stories of the 2004 presidential election was Howard Dean. He was able to raise money over the Internet, you know, just from individuals.
Yeah.
And avoid corporate money.
Well, this is the thing that provides for the possibility of a transformation of the Democratic Party. Because, you know, before, in order to go to the people to get money from average working people, they had to go through the labor unions because there was really no other mechanism for people to give. You know, most people are not going to go through the hassle of sitting down and writing a check and mailing it off, and they don't even know the address and who do you send it to. And, you know, they did direct mail fundraising, but it just never was all that effective. Through the unions, they could do that. But now on the web, I mean, it's easy. People have PayPal accounts or whatever. You know, they just plug in their credit card number, click a button, and boom.
Yeah. Do you think that would work for Senate races and House of Rep races as well?
It does, and it is.
Oh, cool.
It does, and it is. And in fact, the Progressive Democrats of America, and I believe their website is progressivedemocrats.org. We have
It's pdamerica.org.
That's right. Thank you very much. pdamerica.org. You're right. And David Swanson, who's on their board, is very often on our programs on Mondays. And they had, as I recall, they had, I might be mixing them up with a different group, but I don't think so. They had supported six candidates, overtly supported six candidates in the last election for various offices, and five of those six won. That's my recollection. I may be a little bit off, but I don't think so. And they were doing it mostly through the Internet. They were doing, you know, email campaigns, fundraising campaigns. So, and I mean, look at this huge thing, Barbara Boxer, you know, standing up in the House protesting the Ohio vote. That was entirely because of the Internet. And she gets 5,000 roses in her office entirely because of the Internet. We the people who are web connected, which is now, you know, some 60% of America and growing, are becoming a political force independent of the old structures, the corporate structure, the union structure, anything like that. And I think it's a marvelous and wonderful thing. I do believe that we need to strengthen unions and bring them back. And we the people need to be working on that because the unions have been so beat up so badly by the Republicans and by the Democrats who got in bed with them over the years that, you know, it's time for all of us to get active and get involved. But I have tremendous hope. And I think the Internet is going to be one of the main things that makes it happen, Bill.
Yeah.
Bill, thanks for the call. And pass the good word along in Santa Fe. Let your friends know we're back on the air in that market. They're on KRSN 1490. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Ed in New Jersey on the line. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I have a question for you. Basically, with all that's been happening, it's like something every day, you know, we're getting bombarded by the Republicans, you know, Social Security. And my question is, I think everybody forgot about the voting machines. And, you know, that's the only way we're going to get these guys out if it's fixed right. And you don't hear too much about that anymore.
Yeah, well, I wrote a pretty good rant about that this morning and submitted it to commondreams.org. We'll see if they run it. I hope they do. And because yesterday or day before yesterday, I think I mentioned this on the program yesterday, Teresa Hines Carey in Seattle at a fundraiser for, ironically, one of these members of Congress who voted in favor of the bankruptcy bill, but that's a whole nother rant. She was there and she was speaking. And she said that she was concerned about the voting machine. She said 80% of the vote in America is counted by companies run by two brothers, the Yurusovich, or however they pronounce it, Bill and Todd, as I recall, brothers. One is the president of Diebold Voting Systems, and the other was the vice president for consumer relations or customer relations for ES&S, Chuck Hagel's old company. And, yeah, we need to keep our eye on that ball. And I believe that we need to organize somebody needs, some we needs to actually take a leadership role in this. I would love to see MoveOn.org, for example, make this their mission for 2006, where they organize and fund legitimate, solid, reputable exit polls across the country. Get in the Zogby organization or build a group from the ground up. But let's get some really solid exit polls, and let's start looking for vote fraud. And where there's evidence of vote fraud, then let's have a campaign in place in advance, like they did in the Ukraine. You know, that campaign in the Ukraine didn't just appear spontaneously. We participated in that. The Democratic Party, the Republican Party, both have international foundations that help pay for it, as well as a group called Freedom House. And they also had some money from the State Department, the U.S. State Department. And we went in, and before the election, we had come up with a logo, which was a ticking clock. We'd come up with a slogan, which is "Their time is up," in whatever the, you know, in Ukrainian, however you say it in Ukrainian. My daughter would know; she speaks Ukrainian, but I don't. And they had the slogan, and they had the whole. It was all and the orange scarves, the whole bit. I mean, they had it all ready if the election was going to be stolen, because they were pretty sure it was. Because these guys were, you know, this guy was the Yukanovich or whatever his name was, who was the former premier, prime minister, or president, or whatever. He was in bed with Putin. And so, you know, they were pretty sure that this was going to happen. And so that evening, as soon as the vote was done, before the official vote tallies were released by the official state news agency, using the internet, they got out the exit poll results, and they publicized them far and wide, and all these people, and you know, they ran out with the stencils and spray painted logos of these ticking clocks on the sides of mailboxes and sidewalks, and started their protests, and boom, they took back their nation, they took back their election. We need to organize something like that in the United States because of the widespread vote fraud that's going on in this country, both with electronic voting machines and the old-fashioned vote fraud, like we saw in Florida with Kathleen Harris, where, you know, knocking 80, 90,000 people off the voting rolls because they happen to be guilty of the crime of voting while black. And in Ohio, same thing, you know, where Ken Blackwell said, you live in a black district, you can't have voting machines. You live in a white Republican district, you can have an extra one. People need to mobilize and get out. Does that make sense to you, Ed?
It sure does. I hope we take your advice.
Well, I hope, me too, and I, you know, maybe I'll have to start my own organization to do it. I don't know, but
I'll help you.
Okay, well, stay tuned to this channel then, because we'll see how we can, you know, how far we can ride this horse. Ed, I appreciate the call. Great to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, and I think this is Terry, a trucker in Arizona. Is that you on line three there, Terry?
Yep, it's me.
Hey, Terry, what's up?
I got three quick questions, and I'll get through them real quick, and then I'll listen to what you have to say about them, or if you want to interrupt me, go ahead.
All righty.
My first one is, you know, Congress just knocked down minimum wage for people?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm not worried about that. I don't make minimum wage. I get paid by the mile, so I'm not worried about that. But how can Congress, a couple years ago, gave herself a pay raise because of they said that the cost of living went up for them, so they majority gave themselves a pay raise, but they can't give the American people a pay raise.
Well, and in fact, they automatically get a pay raise every year unless they vote not to. That's the new deal. So they don't vote for themselves to get a pay raise every year, but they would have to vote to not get an automatic pay raise. I agree with you. I agree with you absolutely, Angel, or Terry rather, excuse me. And it's not only that. The minimum wage does affect you, and it does affect me, because the American economy is driven by demand. If people want to buy things and they have the money to buy those things, that will cause the economy to grow. So if we raise the minimum wage, then there's going to be more money floating around the economy in the hands of people who spend all of it, as opposed to tax cuts for the rich, where, you know, you give Bill Gates a tax cut, and is he going to go out and buy an extra Mercedes? I don't think so. He's going to invest, you know, he's going to put it in a Swiss bank account, or he's going to put it in a CD or something. It's not necessarily, you know, so the raising the minimum wage, in fact, if you look at the history of the minimum wage, from when it first started in 1936 all the way up to today, every time they've raised the minimum wage, the economy has boomed over the next 2 or 3 years as a result of it.
You got a point. Now that just demolishes my second question, right?
Sure.
What you just said. But now, one thing you said about the economy, if the economy is better, it's better for me because more people are buying stuff and I can haul more stuff.
There you go.
And I can tell you, driving a truck, I rely on the economy. Like the presidential elections, whenever they come up,
mm-hmm.
I hurt real bad.
Yeah.
Whenever, like between New Year's and March, it's really slow for us because everybody's doing their stuff, yada yada.
Yeah.
My other question is, do you think it would be better if we cut Congress down to like a one-term deal, so where they can't get in bed with anybody, they can't get buddy-buddy with these big corporations? Do you think a one-year term and then you're out of there?
That's not the magic bullet, Terry, because you can corrupt somebody in one day. I mean, you know, all you have to do is walk in and say, vote for this bill and I'll give you $100,000 tomorrow morning. And boom, you've got
it. Is there a law against that?
Well, technically there is, but the reality is that for all practical purposes, no, there's not. We used to call it bribery. Now it's called lobbying.
And what does the senator make? 100-something thousand a year?
Yeah, about 115, 120 something. And you know, congressman, a member of Congress, I think senators make a little more, 130, 140.
But now, if they put that money in their campaign fund, that's worth illegal, ain't it?
Well, you see, there's just a million ways around it. You know, we just found out that Tom DeLay has been taking, you know, trips overseas, very luxurious. I mean, $40,000 for a week, you know. It's like, give me a break, right? I mean, there's a lot of ways to bribe a member of Congress. I don't think the term limits are the magic bullet. We tried that, and it doesn't necessarily work. And I think that there's a lot to be said for institutional memory. I think it's really a great thing for us that Everett Dirksen and Barry Goldwater on the right were in the Senate as long as they were. They were, you know, the voices of sanity and wisdom. They'd seen things for a long time. And on the left, that Ted Kennedy and Robert Byrd have been around as long as they have. So,
hey, and I got one quick thing just to ask you a personal question.
Sure.
You know much about truck driving? Do you mean you get in any of that?
I've never been a truck driver, but I would
really appreciate if like you could look into stuff, because like the last time truck drivers actually got a big time raise was back in the 70s.
Yeah,
we're out here. I work an average we're allowed to drive 70 hours, but I work an average of 110 hours a week.
Yeah.
Now I hear these people bitching and moaning because you know. They work 40 hours a week and they cry about it.
Yeah, and Walmart now wants to raise the minimum to 60 hours. 60 hours. Well, I'll have to find the details on that story, actually. I shouldn't just spout it off the top of my head. I'll get to that. But it goes back to the 80s, Terry, and I got to move along. But do you recall the year that trucking got deregulated big time here in the United States?
Oh, yeah.
Which year? Do you know what year it was?
I do believe it was after the 73 strike that we had.
I thought it was in the 80s, Reagan became president.
73 changed it, I think about 1980, 1981, I'm not
yeah, there you
sure
go.
On my date, but we got deregulated, and that really harmed us.
Yeah, exactly. And Louise and I, we started a travel business in Atlanta in 1983, and that was the year after the travel industry got deregulated. And that was, you know, Reagan's stuff. And what we saw in the travel industry was, at first, it looked like a really great thing. And the same in the trucking industry. At first, with deregulation, it looked like a really great thing. But over time, what you discover is that the great big huge corporations got bigger and bigger and bigger. The small ones got priced out of the market. Small in the travel industry, small towns got screwed. They were no longer, you know, they no longer had service. Prices are out of control now. It's just deregulation ultimately. You know, overregulation doesn't work. Deregulation doesn't work. You need a rational middle. Capitalism has to be saved from itself. Terry, I got to move along, but you make a very good point, and you know, it's spot on. Spot on. 1-866-889-8894. Angel in Denver, a trucker. Hey, Angel. Yep, we lost him. Joy in Santa Cruz. Hey, Joy.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I just wanted to give a positive thing. I wanted to contribute a positive bit of news today.
Okay.
According to the Washington Post, the Senate has an impasse on the Clear Skies measure.
Yes, I have that in my stack. I was going to get to it. It's a bit of good news.
It is. It is. And I called Senator Jeffords' office today to thank him.
Oh, he was one of the leaders. In fact, here, now here's the amazing thing. This is what's mind-boggling, Joy. This is in our local newspaper, right? The Burlington Free Press, which is Burlington, Vermont. And uh-huh. It's got a picture of Jim Jeffords and everything. But listen to the opening paragraph. This is the lead sentence, is a one-paragraph sentence. And it says, in a major loss for the Bush administration, a key Senate panel Wednesday defeated a bill to reduce the power plant pollution that has blown mercury and other toxic chemicals into Vermont. End of sentence. Now, they just said that that Jeffords defeated a bill that would have reduced power plant pollution. In fact, this bill would have increased power plant pollution.
Absolutely.
It would have reduced it less than the existing law.
Well, they want to take off the block.
Yeah, I know, but what boggles my mind is that here we've got this Gannett newspaper here in Vermont, you know, where our senators are all, you know, opposed to this clear skies phony baloney.
Uh-huh.
And the lead sentence is misleading. It's misleading
It
says that Jeffords defeated a bill to reduce power plant pollution, and that's just ain't true. Joy, thanks for the call.
Okay.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now you love me as a loser, but now you're worried that I just might win. You know the way to stop me, but you don't have the discipline.
Welcome back. Leonard Cohen is such a brilliant poet. Welcome back 5 minutes before the hour. Pace Cop says, isn't staying with the Democratic Party and expecting a different difference or a different outcome, the definition of insanity? Yes. If you do not participate, yes. However, if you get active, if you get involved, no. It's not the definition of insanity. It's the definition of activism. James in Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, James, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing? I just had two quick comments. One is it was Jimmy Carter that deregulated the transportation industry. I was pretty shocked to find that out myself because I know Ronald Reagan was the king of deregulation.
Yeah, okay. Well, I learned something then, too. Thank you.
Yeah, and secondly, I just want to make a quick comment. As a Republican turned progressive and one who has taken critical thinking, you know what a syllogism is, right?
Yes.
Okay. A equals B, B equals C.
Therefore,
A equals C,
right? Right, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But it ain't necessarily true. No, that's the whole point of it being a syllogism.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. I think that the Republicans have used the last 40 years of their campaign to vilify the Democrats, a simple syllogism. If Democrats equals liberal and liberal equals evil, then Democrats equals evil, right?
Yeah, well, and yes, that's certainly what they've tried to do. They've tried to label, they've tried to take control of the brand. And I wrote a piece for Common Dreams a couple of months ago about how, you know, Democrats and progressives, basically, we need to rebrand ourselves. We need to take back our brand. James, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Wayne in Denver on the line. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, yeah, it was Jimmy Carter, but it was 1984.
84, okay, boy.
Wait a minute, 84
was Reagan.
But it was signed in by Carter in 83. Reagan put it into effect in 84. That's when it went into effect.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay, and at that time, that's when diesel fuel was 67 cents a gallon.
Right.
We were running as an independent around 230, 240 cents a mile.
Yeah.
The five big major trucking companies, Schneider, JB, and all them, between the five of them, they maybe had 10,000 trucks.
Yeah.
Now you look at it now, Schneider has 15,000.
Yeah, it's the same thing happened in the travel industry. When we went into the travel industry in the early 80s, as it was being deregulated, there were thousands, tens of thousands of small travel agencies around the country. Now they're all out of business. And it's just basically the big, you know, the big airlines, the big corporations. Wayne, I got a boogie, but thanks for the call. I appreciate it, and thanks for updating me on that. It's great to, I tell you, we have the smartest listeners on earth on this program. Thanks so much for listening to us. This is the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for our rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Just checking with our chat room. What's the real story on when trucking got deregulated? I guess it's a little bit of everything that our callers were talking about. There was the Motor Carrier Act of 1980. Some deregulation started in 1977, but the big act was in 1980. Actually, not the big act. It was sort of the beginning. And then the Surface Freight Forwarder Deregulation Act of 1986. This under the 1981 would have been under Carter. The 1986 one was Reagan. And that was the one that really kicked the doors open, as far as we can tell. The ICC was already starting to decontrol the industry by 82. And it's obviously one of those things that's a little more complex. Doesn't reduce itself well to sound bites. But the process began in 1980, really picked up steam in the mid-80s. So, that said, and with that information under our belt, it is Thursday. It's the first hour. It's the second hour. First part of our second hour of our Thursday program. Time for us to go a little farther than, you know, a little beyond the news. Let's dig into things that you won't hear about on CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, MSNBC, CNBC, the mainstream media, as it were. Things that you maybe thought you knew, but you didn't know that you didn't know that you didn't know that you didn't know. And maybe even what you thought you knew, you didn't actually know because perhaps everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it possible? Brad Friedman is the writer, the editor of bradblog.com, the blog that broke the story suggesting that Tom Feeney, the congressman from Florida, had hired a fellow by the name of Clint Curtis to write vote hacking software, and Brad is now reporting that let me just lay this out, Brad. Do you think it's true that people who are looking into the issue of the vote being stolen electronically are being murdered?
Well, I will do my best to keep my opinions out of it. What I'm trying to do is stick to the facts, stick to the evidence that I've been able to uncover.
Hey, this is Talk Radio. I'd love to hear your opinion, too, although let's start with the facts.
Well, the facts may be troubling enough for you, but we'll see. I've been looking into this case for about 3 months, reporting on all sorts of elements of it. This particular element of it is one that I have waited to report on at all for a number of reasons, but Clint Curtis, who made these allegations originally back in 2001, has been trying to bring attention to them for years. He not only reported that Feeney had asked him to build some vote rigging software, but also at the company that he was working, that there was Chinese spies working there, illegal aliens, and that the company was overbilling on state contracts and sensitive contracts with NASA were being compromised. Well, it turns out, I'd say about 80-85% of his claims have now been proven true. The Chinese spy who he alleged was a spy and alleged was an illegal alien, turns out the feds have now confirmed he was an illegal alien, and in fact, he was indicted after a four-year sting just last March, I believe it was, for 3 counts of espionage attempting to send Hellfire anti-tank missile chips to China. What happened there is pretty amazing because he ended up pleading guilty to one of those counts, and in the plea agreement said that it was a slow year, so we only did this 10 to 20 times over the past year.
So this was a spy who worked for a company that was somehow in bed with Congressman Tom Feeney of Florida?
Congressman Tom Feeney, at the time, was their corporate counsel, their registered lobbyist, and just happened to be, at the same time, the Speaker of the Florida House. He's the one who famously said back in 2000 during the election mess down there that he didn't care how the Supreme Court ruled. He was going to make sure that Florida's electors went to George Bush.
The Republican
also,
that was Tom Feeney was the guy who said that regardless of the vote count, regardless of what comes out, we are going to send Republican electors to the Electoral College because the Republicans hold a majority in the House of Representatives in the state of Florida. He was the Speaker of the House.
And he was Speaker of the House.
And he's now in the United States Congress.
Yes, sir. He now sits on the House Judiciary Committee.
Oh, my God.
In the U.S. House. He was also, by the way, the running mate to Jeb Bush in 1994 for Jeb's original run for governor of Florida.
When Jeb lost.
Correct.
Wow.
So it's a pretty broad story, and there was a major new element that you mentioned that I finally dealt with. I believe it was yesterday broke this news, which has to do with the original investigator that Clint Curtis went to and gave this information to.
Now, Clint Curtis, let's just clarify here. Clint Curtis is working for this company that also has employed a Chinese spy.
Right.
So he's working side by side with a guy who's a spy, and he's and this company's official lobbyist and lawyer is Tom Feeney, who is also the Speaker of the House of Representatives in the state of Florida, now in the United States Congress representing Florida. And this guy, Clint Curtis, who's working at this company side by side with this spy, goes out publicly and says, A, the guy who's sitting in the cubicle next to me is a spy, and B, Tom Feeney, the Speaker of the House of Representatives in the state of Florida, tried to or successfully did, do you tell me which it is, hired me, Curtis is saying, to write a piece of software that can run on one of these voting machines that will cause the voting machine to, if you enter the certain code or certain order of candidates in a particular way, will cause the voting machine to reset the votes, to change the outcome of the election, right?
Just about right. There's a couple of small details there that do need to be clarified because,
great,
as you can tell, this is an explosive story and it's important to get it right.
Yeah, fill them in for me, Brad.
Yeah.
We're speaking, by the way, of Brad Friedman. He's the writer and the editor of bradblog.com. Go ahead.
The software in question, Clint Curtis was already working for this company, the Yang Company, Yang Enterprises, Inc. So he wasn't hired specifically to do this job. He was taking part in meetings that would happen fairly regularly, he claims, when Tom Feeney would come in and they would discuss projects and so forth that were coming up. So he was tasked in this meeting to build this software. Now, mind you, Clint Curtis at the time was a lifelong Republican and felt when this originally came up that Feeney was concerned that Democrats would try to do this, that they would try to steal the vote. So he wanted to know how they might do it so he would know what to watch for. So what he was asked to build was a prototype, how it might be done. It was never meant that specific program, those specific routines, which is a very simple routine, maybe 24 lines of code, that was meant to be a prototype. It was not meant to go specifically onto voting machines necessarily,
okay,
but rather how it might be done.
Right.
Now, he had asked for very specific, Feeney had asked for very specific things. It needed to be usable on touchscreen voting machines. It
like they have all over Florida.
What's that?
Like they have all over Florida and in the entire state of Georgia.
They do now. They didn't at the time in Florida. However, the software that he was building could have also worked on tabulation machines, which they did have in Florida at that time.
Okay.
So not just the voting machines.
Yep.
As well, they also knew that those machines would be soon coming into the state of Florida.
Okay. We're talking with Brad Friedman, the writer and editor of bradblog.com. So, okay, so Feeney, the head of the Speaker of the House of Representatives for the state of Florida, now in the U.S. Congress, he's the lawyer and the registered lobbyist for this company which has employed a Chinese spy, and he comes and he says to Clint Curtis, write me some vote hack software so that we can find out what the Democrats are going to do.
Correct.
Okay.
He goes away to do that. There was a third thing that Feeney asked for, that they must be able to hide the source code, hide the vote flipping routines in the source code. And Curtis claims that he said at the time, well, that's impossible. They sent him to do it away, to do it anyway. He goes away, writes the software, brings it back on a CD with the documentation, gives it to the CEO, Mrs. Yang, and says, well, I was able to do everything he asked for except to hide the source code. That just can't be done. And she says to him, you don't understand. We have to hide the source code if we want to get the contract. This is to rig the votes in South Florida. That is in Clint's sworn affidavit
which he presented to Congressman John Conyers in Ohio at his open hearings that Congressman Conyers.
Correct. Actually, he gave the affidavit earlier, and then he gave sworn testimony to all of the above to several members of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, okay. Now, Brad Friedman, author of BradBlog.com. We've only got about 2 minutes left here, Brad. Somebody's died. What's going on?
Yes, sir. The fella who, the man from the Florida Inspector General's office down in Florida that Clint first gave this all this material to in 2001, Clint claims that Ray Lemmy is his name, Raymond Lemmy. He came to Clint in 2003, mid-June, said to Clint that the report's about to come out. You're going to be very happy. This thing, the corruption, goes all the way to the top.
The way to the top of the state of Florida or all the way to the top of the United States of America? Are we talking about Jeb Bush or George Bush?
We don't know. All Curtis says that he was told was it goes, quote, all the way to the top.
Okay.
Now, that's what he said in mid-June.
Right.
2 weeks later, Raymond Lemmy was found dead in a Valdosta, Georgia hotel room.
Valdosta, Georgia is right over the border from Florida.
Correct. I asked Clint, well, what the heck was he doing in Georgia? He says, well, Georgia has no autopsy laws, mandatory autopsy laws, so had he committed suicide, as the police eventually ruled it, in Florida, there would have been an autopsy. In Georgia, there was not. I know you got to run, so I'll give you just the quick detail here, is that the police report says that pictures were taken. However, due to a failure in the camera's flash memory cards, there will be no photographs from this crime scene. Well, guess what? We just posted yesterday up on BradBlog.com.
The crime scene photographs.
Correct.
You got them.
And the Valdosta police have acknowledged that they exist and that they opened up the case again in December.
And this may not be a suicide?
I'm sorry?
And this may not be a suicide?
There is a lot of inconsistencies in the photographs compared to the police report. There is a lot of problems with the case. And I've been trying to get more and more information from the Valdosta police, who have essentially told me they opened the case, they spoke with someone at the Florida Department of Transportation, and then closed the case.
Yeah. You don't think Jeb Bush wants this thing going anywhere? Amazing. Brad Friedman, the writer and editor of BradBlog.com. People can find this whole story right on your website, www.bradblog.com.
Yeah, come on by. It's three or four items down. You'll see there's a big siren above it. I've put the graphic photos on a separate page, so you don't have to see them if you don't want. It's an extraordinary story. Please check it out, because this thing continues to unfold.
Amazing. And let's see if the mainstream press picks it up. Brad, thanks so much for being with us. I do appreciate it today on our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Hey, check out commondreams.org. You'll find my article about Teresa Hines Carey. They ran it. And what Teresa has to say. I'd love to hear what you think of this. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, you know about Teresa Hines Carey day before yesterday or 3 days ago in Seattle saying that the voting machines had been hacked?
Yes, I did. I saw a story about that.
Yeah, is that getting much traction in Washington D.C. or is everybody trying to pretend it didn't happen, that she didn't say it?
I think the latter people are trying to perhaps pretend she didn't say it. She doesn't have an awful lot of credibility in Washington. She's seen as kind of a loose cannon, so even if what she's saying is factual, people aren't really listening to it.
Yeah, well, it's a shame because I think it's factual. I'm color me conspiracy nut, but there's got to, you know, if my bank all of a sudden said, hey, you know, on our ATM machines, we're going to stop giving receipts. And by the way, We're not going to show you copies of your canceled checks anymore. You just have to trust us as to how much money you've got in the bank. I'd start to wonder. And yet it's the exact same company that's making the voting machines. Diebold. They say they make my bank's ATMs. Why is it that my voting machine can't have a receipt?
It's a very good question.
And why is it the Republicans are fighting so hard against any kind of law that would force them to have a receipt? Anyhow, that's I'm sure that's not what you called to tell me about. You've got our update from Washington, D.C. for the day. So what's up, Victoria?
Well, I've been in the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing this morning.
Oh, you have my sympathy.
When Vice Admiral Church, who's done this investigation into abuses at Abu Ghraib in Afghanistan and in Guantanamo Bay, presented his report to the senators. And I listened to his testimony and to the question and answer. There's a certain amount of putting it all together that needs to be done after you hear the senators that, you know, ask these questions. But certain things did emerge, one of which was that he and his team never interrogated any of the detainees. Neither did they ever interrogate or question Paul Bremer, the man in charge of the whole shebang.
Oh, wait a minute. So who is this who didn't interrogate anybody?
Vice Admiral Church, who headed up the investigation that was requested or told to do by Defense Secretary Rumsfeld.
So Rumsfeld says, go in and find out what's going on with this abuse. And the guy goes in and he doesn't talk to any of the abused people?
That's correct. He said that they relied on the Red Cross report.
Huh. Why?
Which is actually, I don't know. It's kind of interesting. When he was pushed on some of these issues, he would often say that it was outside of the purview of the report, which it may have been. But the point was made that, well, when it came to Paul Bremer, for example, I mean, you know, he was the guy in charge. And then the vice admiral said that Paul Bremer worked for the State Department as though, you know, there was some lack of crossover. And it was pointed out to him, well, no, he didn't. He worked for the Defense Department.
Yeah, apparently by purview of the report means that the purview of the report was defined by Donnie Rumsfeld. He's the one who said, this is where you'll start. This is where you'll stop. You won't go beyond those edges.
It really was quite fascinating. He certainly, you know, said that they did see abuse and that some had occurred, but he seems to be very clear that there was no policy from top down, although questions being asked about some of these memos, the so-called torture memo and other memos and concerns expressed by FBI people, and then also a fascinating exchange with Senator John McCain in which he was asking about the Geneva Conventions and about the Taliban not having the conventions applied to them,
right.
And saying that the Taliban represented the Afghan government, was fighting for them, and that, you know, should they not have had the Geneva Convention, and why didn't they? To which Church says that, well, the president determined that, you know, their behavior was too egregious, and...
Hey, hang on just a second, Victoria. We've got... Is this Richard at Camp Fallujah in Iraq? Richard, are you on the
phone? It is, Tom. How are you?
It is. Victoria, we've got a fellow in Iraq on the phone.
No, you got to go with Richard.
Yeah. Richard, we've got about 10 seconds here. What's...
Well, I just wanted to check in and say hello, Tom.
Okay.
I'll try to get back to you tomorrow.
Can you hold on over the break, Richard? Richard, can you hold on over the break?
I think I can. If I can, I can call you back in 2 minutes.
Okay, that's fine. Great. Thank you. Let me
on hold. Give Victoria a big hello for me.
Okay, will do. Victoria, big hello from Richard. And Victoria, thanks for the report so far. I got to boogie along here. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
See how they explain the inexplicable. Watch them all debate the undebatable. Apparently a lie is never liable. High time for a talk show screamer.
Yes, indeed, 27 minutes before the hour. The place where smart people get their news. I'm Tom Hartman, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Bill in Chicago on the line. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. When DeLay redistricted Texas, that was only for the local election, correct?
I'm not sure what you mean.
When the Texas legislature was forced to go to neighboring states so that they wouldn't vote for
right,
or against
redistricting.
The redistricting.
No. This was for state and federal. The way that it works is that in the Constitution, it says that every 10 years, every year that ends with a zero, that Congress shall authorize payment for a national census. And
sure.
Then in the 14th Amendment, it talks about how based on that census, and actually in the 14th Amendment, it says based on the number of men. It's the first time the word male appears in the Constitution. Based on the number of voting age men in an area, they will determine how the districts are drawn for representation in the United States Congress. Now, those districts, I believe, are also, maybe they're not. Frankly, I don't know in Texas whether they're used for as local districts or not. But that redistricting in Texas, the delay was in charge of, was for who's going to go to the United States Congress. That I know for sure.
Okay, so it's not a federal crime then? I don't understand why that's not a federal crime and why he's not already rotting somewhere.
Well, in fact, they did the same thing in Colorado the next year. I mean, this is not, by the way, something that's new or Republican. Democrats did this for a long time too.
Right. It's called Chicago, we get that a lot.
Yeah, it's called gerrymandering, and it's named after some congressman named Mander who was in New Jersey, who I believe was a Democrat back in like the 30s or 40s or something like that, who started this whole process and came up with this area that looked like a salamander. Or maybe his name was Jerry. I forget the whole details of the story. But anyway, that's where it all came from. And there have been various efforts to get around this. One, by having an impartial judicial body impaneled, where you'd have like retired judges who were not political hacks or whatever, and they would come up with the areas. Other attempts to say that the areas have to be geographically or geometrically, like trapezoidal or something like that. You know, variations on a square. You know, they can't be these weird little things with look like a dumbbell, you know, or something like that. So far, none of that has been successful. And through gerrymandering all across the United States, you now have basically a situation where about 95, 96, 97%, depending on whose numbers you use, of the members of the House of Representatives have what are called safe seats. They're not going to get bounced out because they've been able to grab enough people that will vote for them simply because of their party affiliation that they don't have to worry about it.
Okay.
And it's not a good thing for democracy.
Right. That I understand.
And both parties are complicit in it.
I'm sorry?
Both parties are complicit in it. Both parties have done this at various times.
Right.
It's just the Republicans have raised it to an art form, but it's an old Democratic trick as well.
Right. And just one other thing, I heard Clinton Curtis a couple months ago on Air America. He was actually on the air himself speaking with Rachel Maddow on a morning show.
Yeah.
And it was quite compelling and it's quite frightening.
Yeah.
Is it not?
Yeah, it is. It really is.
It sounds like a conspiracy theory, except that he sounded truly fearful and shaken in his belief.
Yeah, this is a story that I hope goes a little farther. I actually referenced it in the article I wrote for Common Dreams today and pointed to the testimony that he gave before Conyers Committee. So there's a link to that in the article that I put up on Common Dreams today. So you can check
Wild
that out.
Wild stuff. Welcome to the Twilight Zone.
There you go. Bill, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you, and thanks for waiting to be on the program. I do appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. I want to get back to this Clear Skies Initiative thing. And, by the way, TomHartmann.com, our website, if you want to drop into the chat room. Eldridge Jerry, not a Mr. Mander. Thank you, Revan, in our chat room. See, the chat room knows everything. I'm telling you, it is the collective brain of the universe. So Congressman Eldridge Jerry was the first one to gerrymander a district, or who came up with gerrymandering, and therefore... Back here, gerrymander, when districts are divided using irregular delineation in order to give one political, this is from Sue in the United Kingdom, who has become an expert on American politics, I suspect, when in order to give one political group an advantage over another, often frequently referred to as political gerrymandering or jurisdictional gerrymandering, see U.S. versus Hayes, 515, U.S. 737, 1995, and Miller versus Johnson, 1995. So, Supreme Court cases that... I guess, said, yeah, you can do this. Anyway, a major loss for the Bush administration. Go ahead. Richard's back with us from Iraq. Let's just veer off in that direction. Richard Miller with the Talk Radio News Service from Camp Fallujah in Iraq. Hey, Richard.
Hi, how you doing today, Tom?
I'm well. What's up in Iraq?
Well, I'll report plenty of action, but Fallujah is as quiet as a tomb, no pun intended. If anything, the Marines here have been complaining that they're bored since the offensive has pretty much reduced insurgent activity to a zero.
Now, hasn't it pretty much reduced all human activity in Fallujah to a zero, or have the citizens of the city started returning?
No, I think they've actually begun to return. From what I understand, the camps that were set up to house them during the offensive have begun to empty.
Yeah, okay. And so what's your sense of the legitimacy? I'd like to ask about these elections that were just held. I've had a couple of people on. Scott Ritter the other day was on this program, and he was speculating that the party that won the 48%, which was this the Dawa Party, I guess it's called, that he thought that they actually won 51%, but that we had to kind of suppress that vote, or they would have just taken over and kicked us out, and we'd have a theocracy in Iraq right now. Do you give any credibility to that, any credence to that?
No, I don't, simply because the election would have been too easy to steal for the Shia had they been able to do it, if you follow my point.
Well, that was Scott's point, that they actually did. I mean, that they actually won it, but they didn't, you know.
No.
I interrupted you. Okay. Go ahead.
With 60% of the population, there would have been no way for any vote rigging.
Yeah. Okay.
This time around.
So you think it was pretty straightforward, Richard? What's your sense? What's your sense of the future there?
Well, to begin with, Tom, most of what I earn comes through this, because I, at least until tomorrow, will have very little contact with Iraqis. Tomorrow, that may begin to change. But the soldiers, and I've spoken with hundreds of them, report that the elections have made one very important difference in regards to the fighting capability of the ISF, which is the Iraqi Security Force.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that morale has improved geometrically.
That's marvelous
news. January 30th.
That's marvelous news. Now, in the midst of this, here in the last 2 days, we've had these massacres of these same forces, these same people. What is the response of you know, what's that about? What's going on with that?
Well, you know, interestingly, Tom, you probably know a lot more about that than I do, because embedded here in a forward operating base, we have very little access to news other than what's in front of my eyes and around my ears.
I see. Interesting. So tomorrow you're going to get out and you're going to talk to some local Iraqis and get a little more of a pulse of things.
Yeah. One of the things that the Marines, one of the things done here is that at the around the various bases, they have made missions available on a first basis.
They've made what available? I'm sorry. You're breaking up. They've made what available?
I'm going to observe medical services.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Available to the local population, and I'm going to be observing some of that tomorrow.
So we're providing, wasn't the hospital in Fallujah the first building that we shut down because we said it was a source of propaganda when we first invaded
Fallujah?
Yeah,
I went through that today. It actually shut down. It was taken over.
Right.
But it was kept open for medical treatment for both civilian and non-civilian casualties.
It was. That's good to hear because that's not the story that I had originally heard, and I always wondered about that. Okay, so we're doing good stuff there right now. We're going in and we're offering medical services to the local people. This has got to be something that'll endear them to us rather than us shooting at them.
Yeah, no, I agree. And as was the case in post-war Germany, and the military's objective here are not only to but to try to give as much life as they can.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Richard, any other gems you'd like to share with us, or hopefully we can talk with you later on in the week or early next week about your take on what the average Iraqi has to say after you've had a chance to get out there and talk with them?
Well, Tom, what I'd like to do is have the opportunity to come back again on your wonderful show and talk about it once I've got what I would call a better data sample.
Great. Any time, Richard. You have the number, and I appreciate your calling from the Talk Radio News Service all the way from Iraq, from Camp Fallujah there. Thanks so much for being with us today.
I appreciate that, and thank you, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
Great. Thank you. It's 17 minutes before the hour, 16 minutes now before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's get back to the Clear Skies Initiative. Iraq is, I have so many mixed emotions about the situation in Iraq. I really want this to work out well. We've killed 100,000 civilians, according to The Lancet, the British medical journal, the only group that's really done a solid survey, I think. You know, there's a website that purports to have the body count, and they're saying it's around 15,000, 20,000, but The Lancet's saying, anyhow, a lot of civilians, certainly many more than died in 9/11, which had nothing to do with Iraq anyway, but nonetheless, for comparison purposes. And we've lost 1,500-plus soldiers now. We've lost, you know, well over 10,000 have lost limbs or ears or eyes. The cost in human blood, the cost in treasure to the United States has been enormous. And this is something that I absolutely hold George W. Bush accountable for, say that he has blood on his hands. And at the same time, we're there. And we've got to make the best of this, and we've got to turn it into something good. We must. We just must. And we have to, we have to hope for the best, work for the best. Whether it accrues political benefit to George W. Bush or not, I don't care, frankly. I would like to see the killing stop and this country work things out. The Clear Skies Initiative. The reason I want to talk about this Clear Skies Initiative thing is because there's some other mercury news in the news today, a couple of them actually, that I think are really worth noting. First of all, Bush's so-called clear sky. I mean, no matter what they say, like my friend Hal the other night, he runs a community action center here in Vermont, and he was saying that Bush's plan to gut funding for community action centers across the country is called the Strengthening Our Communities Act, or words to that effect. It's Orwellian doublespeak is always coming out of this administration. It's just, you wonder how some of these people like Scott McClellan can sleep at night. In any case, Jim Jeffords, the independent from Vermont, and here in the Burlington Free Press, it says D Vermont. This is the Vermont newspaper, and they identify him as a Democrat. He's an independent. He says, we must strive to build upon the success of the Clean Air Act, not gut it. But the opening paragraph, it's an article by Aaron Kelly, Free Press Washington writer. What are they rent Aaron from the Mooney Times, the Washington Times, Reverend Moon's Washington Times? I mean, I don't get it. In a major loss to the Bush administration, a key Senate panel Wednesday defeated a bill to reduce the power plant pollution that has blown mercury and other toxic chemicals into Vermont. If you just read that opening paragraph, you would think, that Jim Jeffords, he just defeated a bill that's going to reduce the amount of mercury that comes into Vermont. And in fact, the Clear Skies Initiative would have reduced the amount of mercury coming into Vermont and the rest of the United States by about 70%. But the existing law will reduce it by 90%. So in truth, what happened was that what was defeated was a bill that would have increased the allowable amount of pollution and mercury. But that's not the way that the Gannett newspaper, Burlington Free Press, chose to spin the story. This is incredible. Now, a little later on, farther down into the story, where a lot of people don't ever read, like the last paragraph, environmentalists and public health groups hailed the vote as a major victory. Quote, millions of children and adults with lung diseases like asthma, emphysema, and chronic bronchitis can breathe easier with the news that the administration planned to severely weaken efforts to curb air pollution died on Capitol Hill today, said John Kirkwood, president of the American Lung Association. Last paragraph. And to get to that paragraph, you had to move three pages into the newspaper. And they say we have a liberal press. This is what Jim Jeffords said. He said, we must strive to build upon the success of the Clean Air Act, not gut it. Bush's plan, he said, allows the oldest, dirtiest power plants to increase pollution without installing anti-pollution technology and gives power plants an extra 10 years to continue to avoid reducing mercury pollution. And that's exactly right. Why does the lead sentence say a key Senate panel Wednesday defeated a bill to reduce power plant pollution? I don't get it. Well, I do get it, and I'm horrified by it. And then they quote Jim Inhofe, the Republican from Oklahoma. Clear Skies Act is better than current law. Yeah, right. It's better for the power industry. In fact, that's what he says. He says the status quo means more litigation and more costs. Gee, and cleaner air. 10 minutes before the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Don't worry about a thing. Every little bit gonna be all right.
Oh yeah, it's all it will shake out. It will work out.
About a thing.
People are waking up, my friends. And you are part of the process. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense in the radical middle. I'm Tom Hartman with you. Discussion in our chat room here. What's Bush up to next? What's Rove up to? I think it was Fritz DeCat. I'm not sure. Asked, do you see Bush attacking Iran? I think not. I think they've got the goods on him. Notice we talked about this yesterday in the third hour of the program. How? Iran, I believe it was the third hour of the program, how Iran has said that if we try messing with them, they are going to cut off our oil. They are the second largest member of OPEC. You mess with Iran, you're messing with OPEC. And that's something George Bush just can't afford to do right now. But he can go after Syria, particularly if he can do it the same way he did with Saddam Hussein. That is, make sure that they have no weapons of mass destruction. Make sure that they have little ability to defend themselves, that they have no nukes, and then you go in and take them out. And so they're checking it out right now. Let's make sure that Syria is weak so that we can attack them. And my prediction, it'll happen right around 2006, right around the midterm elections, just in time for the midterms. Nothing like a good war to get the Republicans into office. Back to Mercury. Another article in the Vermont paper today, the Burlington Free Press, this one by Candace Page, a little more rational Free Press staff writer. Contamination of the environment by toxic mercury. Oh, hey, we've got a call. I'm sorry. I missed that. Tim in Illinois is on the line. Hey, Tim. Sorry, I slid right by it. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the Viagra for the brain.
You're welcome.
I just talked to the managing editor at the Burlington Free Press.
Uh-huh.
About the Clear Sky story, and he was flummoxed and didn't know what I was talking about when I said the lead should include the word increase, not decrease.
Right.
And he said, well, he'll take a look at it, and if it should say increase, he will run a correction on page 2 tomorrow.
Yeah, well, see, technically they're accurate. The Clear Skies Initiative would decrease the amount of pollution. It's just that it would decrease it less than the current existing law. So then,
right, and I had that conversation with him, and he did not seem aware of that, or he skirted it and said something else.
Yeah, well, you know, these guys work for Gannett. I mean, it's, well, anyhow, good on you, Tim. I'm really pleased that you called the newspaper. I'm really impressed. Thank you so much for doing that.
All right, bye.
Yeah, and thanks for calling and filling us in, letting us know about it. See, that's what you got to do. Keep them on their toes. Keep them going. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. The uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from California to West Virginia, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, Live365's American FM, and on CRN Digital in 29 states. Republicans pushed a $2.57 trillion budget towards House Budget Committee approval on Wednesday. Now, this is really interesting. The Republicans in the House and the Republicans in the Senate are having a disagreement, a slight disagreement, between the House and the Senate about how badly they should slash spending for old people, sick people, and poor people in America. And also in the Senate, you've got at least two Republican senators who are saying, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't do this quite so much. But there seems to be a broad consensus across the Republican Party that if they are going to have tax cuts for the rich, and George W. Bush wants to make permanent his 15% maximum income tax rate for those millionaires and billionaires who earn their living like much of his family does, you know, the trust fund baby bunch, like he himself, for that matter, who earn their income. Well, of course, right now he gets a paycheck as president, but anytime he wants, he can just sit back. And in fact, most of his income comes from dividends and interest and that sort of thing. You know, you own stock. The company makes a profit. They pay part of that profit out to their stockholders. It's called dividend payment. So if you earn your living like the Walton family does, for example, sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail, then the maximum income tax you will pay is 15%. Plus, you don't pay any Social Security tax at all. Sweet deal if you can get it, right? Well, you got to be rather wealthy. Yes, I know that there are some average Americans who actually get dividends, and it amounts to just about squat compared to the mass, you know, the largest amount of. So the Republicans are sitting around saying, okay, we're going to have this dividend. We're going to have this tax cut. George W. Bush's tax cuts for the millionaires and the billionaires. We got to have those things. And so if we're going to have these tax cuts, we've got to figure out where to cut government spending. And we're not going to cut it in defense, because that's going to corporations that give us a pile of money. So over $400 billion is going to defense. We can't cut the payments on the interest. Now, you know, this year we're paying $180 billion in interest on the money that Ronald Reagan borrowed back in the early 80s to make the economy look good enough that he could get himself reelected in 84. We can't cut that, because you've got to pay that interest. Those are IOUs that you just have no choice. And we've got to pay that money back to China and to Japan and to the Saudis and the Brits and the occasional wealthy family in the United States who loaned us that money so that Reagan could make times look good. And so far we haven't been able to cut Medicare or Social Security, although they're in the crosshairs. So what's left? What's left? As the Associated Press, Alan Fram, a writer for the Associated Press, noted, just the opening sentence of this article just nails it. The Republicans pushed a $2.57 trillion budget toward House Budget Committee approval on Wednesday, this yesterday, answering record federal deficits, of course these caused by tax cuts for the billionaires, answering record federal deficits by seeking broad cuts in domestic programs and carving deeper into benefits for the poor and students than even President Bush proposed. What you are seeing, my friends, writ large, is the starve the beast strategy. Reagan did it. Bush is doing it. You create a crisis by cutting taxes for the very richest among us, for the millionaires and billionaires, cut off funding to the government, and then you run around going, Oh no, we've got deficits. We're running in the red. We can't do this any longer. We've got to cut spending. The government is spending too much. We've got to, Head Start program. Well, yeah, I know you invest $300 in a child in Head Start and you save about $7,000 over their lifespan and on average, because fewer of them end up in prison and you don't have to pay for it, and fewer of them end up on welfare, but still, it's $300. We'll cut that. That's just kids. They've already been born. Not a priority. And let's see. We've got these students over here, these Perkins grants, or Perkins loans programs, student loans for people who want to go to trade school because their job got outsourced to China or India. They want to go to trade school. They want to learn a new trade. Forget that. They don't contribute to the Republican Party. You got these unionized workers here in the factories. They're mostly Democrats. No need for any extended unemployment benefits for them. But we've got to keep those tax cuts for the billionaires. Got to keep those. Can't have the Walton family upset with us. Democrats said the GOP plans, this from the Associated Press, would harm people who rely on federal programs and mask how bad deficits will be by omitting much of the future cost of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, a long-term easing of the alternative minimum tax, and Bush's plan to revamp Social Security. Revamp? How about dismantle? They go on to note, based on the House committees assigned to find the savings, this is mind-boggling. Absolutely mind-boggling. The GOP, the Republicans in the House, they say, okay, we're going to cut $69 billion. In fact, Jim Nussle, Republican of Iowa, he says, personally, I, and I know many of my colleagues, would like to have gone even further. But anyhow, they decided they're going to cut $69 billion. It's $20 billion more than Clinton, or than Bush said. Where are they going to cut it? They're not going to tell us. We're just going to cut it. We'll let you know when we're done. And probably it's going to be some giant piece of legislation with 5,000 things in it, and it'll be passed at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they'll have to hold the vote open for 3 hours like they did with the Patriot Act, was it? And based on the House committees assigned to find the savings, this Associated Press is speculating, where are they going to cut this money? Where are they going to find it? Based on the House committees assigned to find the savings, the Medicaid program for the poor and elderly could be targeted for up to $20 billion in five-year cuts. Now, the Medicaid program... these are the state-run programs for the poor and elderly to provide medical services. And the states pay for most of it, but they do get some federal matching funds. So they're saying here, the Republicans in the House are saying, just leave it to the states. Let them raise the state taxes. That way, all the rich folks can move to Nevada or Texas or Florida or New Hampshire or, you know, where the taxes are only paid by the working people, where they don't have an income tax, they just have consumption taxes. You get to pay for taxes when you buy things. So if you're somebody who spends most of your income, you pay most of the taxes. You save a lot of your income, you're a millionaire, a billionaire, you don't pay so much tax. Plus reductions in student loans, welfare, and for programs for farmers and veterans. And you can bet when they say farmers, they really mean farmers. They don't mean agribiz. They mean farmers. Democrats in the House panel offered a parade of amendments aimed at blocking the use of Social Security surpluses to pay for tax cuts. Maybe you didn't realize. Again, something, for some reason, ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, CNBC, CNN, faux news, they don't mention every year. Well, the budget deficit this year was $423 billion. Well, actually, we borrowed $200, $250 billion out of the Social Security Trust Fund as well. The actual budget deficit was more like $500, $600 billion. Oh, but we owe that money to ourselves. Yes, but we owe it. And the ourselves we owe it to is the retirees. Oh, but we're going to fix that, so you don't have to worry about that. Yeah. We're gonna set it up so that we can have spent that money on tax cuts for the rich, and those retirees, well, you know, maybe we can figure out a way to convince them that the AARP is a commie organization that's only interested in guys kissing. And then we'll get them all confused, and they won't know who to vote for. That's the solution. And we'll cut back on funding for the USDA for the inspection for mad cow disease, and maybe enough of them will get mad cow disease. I can just see it now. The Republicans sitting around. Okay, how are we going to deal with these old folks? Well, let's make them crazy. That'll work. Democrats on the House panel offered a parade of amendments, as I said, aimed at blocking the use of Social Security surpluses to pay for tax cuts and boosting federal spending for veterans. What? Say the Republicans. You want to increase spending for veterans? How dare you? No, we're going to cut spending for veterans. Democrats also wanted to increase funding for schools. Schools? There's bombs to buy. Come on, we gotta buy some more bombs. What is this? Schools nonsense. Invest in the future? Bridges? Potholes? Infrastructure? Come on. We gotta figure out a way to shovel more money to the pharmaceutical companies and the defense industry. We've got to outsource some more jobs here. Corporate CEOs want to raise their salaries. They note that these Democratic proposals to block the use of Social Security surpluses to pay for tax cuts and to increase spending for veterans, schools, and other programs, and I quote, all seemed destined for failure. The House budget also called for $106 billion in tax cuts for the wealthiest among us. Of course, this would be in the form of extending after 2008, when it's set to expire, Bush's 15% maximum tax rate for those who make their living sitting around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive. Wait till you hear what's going on in the Senate. It gets juicier. And then what George W. has to say about Social Security. This is mind-boggling. He can't keep his own words straight. 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hello, trouble. Come on in. You talk about heartaches. Where in the world you been? I ain't had the miseries.
And welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. See, what this is all about, I mean, what it boils down to essentially is a fundamental difference in worldviews, and one that, I mean, you could argue this is a legitimate debate. This is a debate that's been going on in the United States for a long, long time. It literally goes back to the debates that were being held in 1776. I mean, seriously, about what role government should play in our lives, to what extent government should be providing a social safety net. For example, in 1810, James Madison, fourth president of the United States. James Madison vetoed a bill where Congress had voted for money to take care of the poor in Washington, D.C., but they were going to give the money to a church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor. And President James Madison vetoed it. It was the first veto of his presidency. And he didn't veto it because he felt that government shouldn't take care of the poor. He did. He believed that government should play that role, that a community should take care of its own. This was for widows and orphans, literally for widows and orphans. It wasn't that he was opposed to that. It was that he just didn't think the money should go through a church. He was concerned that if we were to do faith-based initiatives, that government would start corrupting the churches, that the churches would become politicized, that they'd start advocating for particular political candidates, and then they wouldn't be churches anymore. Because the whole point of a church or a synagogue or any other religious institution is to promote promote spirituality among their members, not to take political positions. And Madison was, yeah, you could argue Madison was a liberal in his time. You know, he felt that there should be, that the government should be providing some compassion and support. And when he vetoed the bill, he sent it back to Congress and he said, no, let's create a government institution, a government agency, not a church, to distribute this money to these widows and orphans here in Washington, D.C. And they did. And that was, I mean, the country was only 30 years old at the time. But there were then, and there are now, some people, and it's a small percentage, actually. Right now, you look at most of the surveys, and it's somewhere, depending on how you phrase the question, somewhere between 5 and 25% of Americans who really think that government should have no participation whatsoever in welfare programs or in anything that you know, helps out people who have fallen on hard times. Unemployment, you know, all these kind of things. Now, oddly, those would be the same people who would say that they want middle-class welfare. They would like, thank you very much, to be able to deduct the mortgage interest on their homes from their income taxes. That's welfare for the middle class. They're all in favor of that. But they don't want welfare for the poor. In any case, there is this small percentage. And you've got, of course, the very, very wealthy who don't want to be paying taxes to take care of the poor. They're like, hey, you know, we've got our gated community. The problem is that historically, and you look at the history of this country, this happened in the 20s. It happened basically from the 1880s to the late 1920s. And it's happened again from the 1980s up until right now. And hopefully it won't take until 2020 for the pendulum to swing again. But we've been through these cycles now. This is the third time in the United States. It also happened in the 1850s, where the conservatives essentially took control of the government, slashed these social programs, created massive poverty in the United States, and did it against the will of the majority of the people, just by basically brute political force. And they're doing it again. And they're using newspeak. They're using, you know, double language that doesn't mean what it seems to imply, you know, from Clear Skies Initiatives to Healthy Forest Initiative, all this kind of stuff. And now it's like, well, we're going to save Social Security. Right. You know, it's in a crisis. Right. So anyhow, that's what's at the core of this. And I would appreciate it if the conservatives, and there's a few Democrats among this bunch, but it's mostly Republicans, if the conservatives who actually believe that the government should not play any role in helping us out just came out and said it. And let's really cut the welfare programs. Let's let people pay interest on their mortgages. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, paint it black. And welcome back.
I see a red door and I want it painted black. No colors anymore, I want them to turn black.
Well, is it blue states or red states? Or is everything turning black? Kind of a depressing song, actually. We'll let that one slide. In the Senate on Wednesday, as Republican... By the way, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. TomHartman.com. If you'd like to drop into our chat room, click the live chat button. It'll take you to our message board. Click live chat there, and it will take you to the chat room. If you'd like to call in, our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. Now, we talked about what's going on in the House. Over in the Senate, sort of the same in the Senate on Wednesday, as Republican leaders offered a budget. This is from the New York Times. Article by Cheryl Gay Stolberg and David D. Kirkpatrick. But it looks like the senators in the Republicans in the Senate are not quite as enthusiastic about slashing away at the social safety net or cutting taxes for the very, very wealthy, for the millionaire, the multimillionaires and billionaires among us, as are the members of the House of Representatives. Maybe it's because they're elected for 6 years at a time instead of two, and they're not quite as concerned about the next election cycle. It's really interesting, the difference in the dynamic between the House and the Senate. They're very, very different bodies. The Senate is more, they were modeled after the House of Commons and the House of Lords in the United Kingdom. And in a way, they still are. The Senate is sort of the thoughtful, deliberative, aristocratic, traditionally representing the interests of the very wealthy. Although to a large extent, it depends on which party is in power. So representing the interests of, let's say, the party in power. Because it was the Senate back during when LBJ was in the Senate that was pushing so hard for things like the Great Society, which cut poverty in the United States in half during LBJ's tenure as president. And then over in the House, it's more like the House of Commons. It's sort of like a brawl, an ongoing fist fight. And you're only elected for 2 years at a time and a little more answerable to we the people in theory, although with all the gerrymandering that's been going on, not quite the case. But anyhow, this article in the New York Times today, President Bush's plan to extend his tax cuts over the next 5 years ran into resistance in the Senate on Wednesday, as Republican leaders offered a budget for 2006 that would undo more than a fourth of the cuts that Mr. Bush has requested. Interesting. Uneasy about the potential impact on the ballooning federal deficit, writes Stolberg and Kirkpatrick, the Senate Republicans called for $70.2 billion in tax cuts over the next 5 years, as opposed to the $100 billion the White House is seeking. And you will recall the House is asking for $106 billion in tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. Senator Judd Gregg, the New Hampshire Republican, chairman of the Budget Committee, and frothing at the mouth mad dog on behalf of billionaires, said his intent was to extend reductions on capital gains and dividend taxes, which are set to expire in 2008. In other words, in 2008, people who make their living sitting around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive are going to see their income taxes go back up to where they have to pay the same income tax that you and I have to pay. And Judd Gregg doesn't like that idea. He doesn't think that people who make their living sitting around waiting for the dividend check to arrive should have to pay as much tax as you and I. After all, they don't work as hard. Why should they pay as much tax? And that was the rationale of the third Bush tax cut. Right now, the folks who earn their living that way only pay a maximum 15% income tax. Period. No Social Security taxes, nothing, just 15% income tax, flat rate, maximum. And old Judd Gregg thinks that's just a fine thing. That tax cut should not expire in 2008. That should continue on into infinity. In fact, he told reporters, I used to live in New Hampshire, right? I lived in New Hampshire from 1978 to 1983. And New Hampshire is not a state full of millionaires and billionaires. There are probably a few. There's probably a few hundred millionaires, and there might even be a couple of billionaires there. But most of the people who vote in New Hampshire are not millionaires and billionaires, and most of the people who vote in New Hampshire do not make their living sitting around the, this time of year, frozen pool waiting for the tax, waiting for the dividend check to arrive. So how is it that the United States Senator from New Hampshire can get away with going in front of reporters and saying, I think we can get most of the expiring provisions, which I happen to consider to be fairly benign provisions with a lot of support, under the $70 billion umbrella. I think it's an appropriate approach. Well, I can tell you how he gets away with saying it. He gets away with saying it because he's using Senate speak. And Joe Sixpack in New Hampshire has no idea that what Judd Gregg, their senator, just said is, we're going to screw the average working guy so that people who are the millionaires and billionaires who earn their living sitting around the pool waiting for the dividend checks only have to pay 15% taxes. And the newspapers are not reporting that because the liberal media in America is owned by the conservative corporations. You think you have liberal media in this country? Really? Representative Paul D. Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin. Another one of these guys who thinks that his entire state is made up of millionaires and billionaires, or probably more correctly, knows that his campaign donors are millionaires and billionaires. Paul D. Ryan of Wisconsin says, we would like it to go further. He said conservatives, this is from this article in the New York Times, last paragraph, he said conservatives plan to push for spending cuts in Medicare despite President Bush's threat to veto any changes to the costly prescription drug benefit passed by Congress in 2003. This is Medicare. This is single-payer health care. This is the national, for poor people and elderly people, this is the national health insurance program. And Bush, of course, says he's going to veto any cuts to the drug benefit part of it because it requires that the government not be allowed to negotiate discounts with the drug companies. Therefore, people on Medicare are paying full retail for their pharmaceuticals. So the pharmaceutical industry is making hundreds of billions of dollars in additional revenue out of your tax dollars and mine. Who's paying Medicare taxes? You and me. After the first $90,000, you don't pay it. So, you know, he says, Bush says, you can't cut that. You can't go in there and take that money out for the drug companies. So what are they going to do? Well, they'll just say, okay, if you go to the hospital, the deductible is higher. If you have procedure, the deductible is higher. You want to see your doctor, the deductible is higher. They'll figure out a way to squeeze it out of the old folks. As Congressman Ryan says, we know that is an area, he's speaking of Medicare, we know that is an area where you can find savings without undoing the spirit of the law. The spirit of the law that he's referring to being George W.'s dictum that the pharmaceutical companies kept the Republican Party in power, the pharmaceutical companies are going to get their money out of your pocket and mine. Speaking of Medicare and its twin, Social Security, this interesting analysis in the Daily Kos, one of the better blogs out there. Is it Kos or Kos? I think it's Daily Kos. Maybe even as cause. But in any case, the George W. Bush is giving speeches about Medicare. And they are incoherent. And the liberal media, owned by conservative corporations, are not pointing out the fact that they're incoherent. They're not saying, you know, what's this guy trying to say? Instead, they just kind of let it slide by. And so, it's left to the bloggers to say, what's he talking about? Here's a quote from George W. Bush, a speech on Medicare a couple days ago. This is a retirement account we're talking about, but it's your money. There's that old Sean Hannityism, right? It's your money. Like, we don't live in a society. We don't have any social contract. Anyhow, but it's your money, and the interest off that money goes to supplement the Social Security check that you're going to get from the federal government. See, personal accounts is an add-on to that which the government is going to pay you. Now, add-on is a magic word that Republicans are not supposed to use. Because the Democrats have been saying ever since Franklin Roosevelt, hey, we've got Social Security. It's not a retirement program. It's an insurance program. It's insurance against poverty. It's insurance against disaster. That's what it is. It's an insurance program. If you're a 10-year-old kid and your parents get killed in a car accident, Social Security will take care of you. If you're 45 years old and you break your neck and you're paralyzed, Social Security will take care of you. If you're 70 years old and you're retired and you're poor, Social Security will make sure you don't have to eat dog food. It's an insurance program. And Democrats have been saying forever to Republicans, hey, if you want to add on to this a retirement program, a pension, add that on to Social Security where people can voluntarily or even involuntarily, and I would have to say, frankly, I would be more in favor of the voluntary. But nonetheless, either one would be fine. If you want to add on a retirement program and, you know, jack the Social Security tax up by 2 points so that everybody has, you know, and put that money, put it in the stock market or bonds or whatever you want, doesn't matter. And people take that out as retirement, that's fine. But that's an add-on. But see, the conservative agenda since the beginning, since Social Security was first passed without a single Republican vote, when Franklin Roosevelt had Democrats in charge of the House and the Senate, ever since that day, the Republican agenda, the conservative agenda, has been to dismantle Social Security because they view it as socialism. They view it as something that they think is undesirable. They don't think that the government should be providing a social safety net. Families should do that. Churches should do that. That's their philosophy and their belief. That we as a society, as a larger society, have no responsibility to ourselves. That the idea of community should be entirely local. And that if somebody had to move across the country to get a job, and they get sick and they don't have family that they can move in with, well, tough. They shouldn't have done that. And, you know, give them credit. That's their worldview. At least a few of them are honest enough to say it. But the word add-on is one you just don't use. The Republicans don't use with regard to Social Security. It is a word that is forbidden. And here is George Bush saying this. He says, so personal accounts is an add-on. I'm not even going to correct his English. See, personal accounts is an add-on to that which the government is going to pay you. It doesn't replace the Social Security system. It is a part of making, dash, getting a better rate of return, though, so, dash, to come closer to the promises made. That's important to know. So, Mike Allen of the White House press office comes out to explain what George meant. And this is incredible. He says, well, the president on Friday described private and personal accounts as an add-on to Social Security, something extra. And that set off a lot of bells because Democrats said either he's being deceptive or he's completely changing his negotiating position. I checked on this. The White House says he has not changed anything. They said it's just how it came out, and you won't hear that again. In other words, the White House is saying, George Bush has no idea what he's talking about. Ignore what he says. And he won't say it again, by the way. We've corrected him. You know, Reagan used to do this, but it was when he had Alzheimer's. What is it about Republican presidents? You know, I just don't get it. Eisenhower, good guy, good president. I salute Ike. But then we had a crook. We had Nixon. We had a guy with Alzheimer's, and now we've got a fellow who can't speak English. And doesn't, and you know, they have not put forward an actual proposal for Social Security. Why? Because they're going to do the same thing they did with the Patriot Act, the same thing they did with the Iraq legislation. They roll this stuff out at the last minute. Nobody has a chance to read it. And they say, vote up or down, yes or no, right now. And we're gonna make campaign ads, Max Cleland, calling you a traitor if you don't vote for this thing, even if you haven't had time to read it. Really, that's what they did. And, well, it's a whole other argument about the voting machines. Check out commondreams.org today if you want to see my rant on the voting machines and Max Cleland. That's a slight digression, but that's what's going to happen. They're going to roll this thing out, or it's going to go away. I predict it's going to go away. They've touched the third rail. It's 10 minutes before the hour. The pill that'll help you escape the matrix right here.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I think it's time for a change, 'cause I'm tired of these games. I'm gonna leave them inside, 'cause I'm all right on the outside.
Time for a change. Yes, we could use a new administration. By the way, this just in, as they say in the news business. As I used to, back in the years when I was a news reporter, I was for 7 years back in the early 70s. For 7 years, I did news every day in radio and, well, a whole long story. Anyway, U.S. troops, this from the Associated Press, U.S. troops who mistakenly killed an Italian intelligence agent last week on the road to Baghdad's international airport. Everybody's been, you know, the U.S. government has been saying, well, there was this checkpoint. These guys tried to run through this checkpoint. And the Italians are saying, there was no checkpoint. We were just driving along, and all of a sudden we got this blinding light, and then suddenly they just started shooting at our car. Turns out it wasn't one of the regular checkpoints. In fact, it might not have even been a checkpoint at all. It might not even have been visible. It was part of John Negroponte's, yes, the guy who ran the death squads out of Nicaragua when he was our ambassador to El Salvador way back when. John Negroponte, Mr. Electrodes on the gonads, John Negroponte, who is the ambassador to Iraq, that his security detail was alongside the road, you know, looking out for anything suspicious. And they shot up this car and killed the lead guy, you know, this is one of these top guys in Italian intelligence. And Silvio Berlusconi is not happy. And he's an important ally in the so-called war on terror. And so the United States is having to come up with a little truth here, because Berlusconi is not letting them get away with the, oh, they tried to run a checkpoint, which is the normal routine that is put out when somebody gets what the soldiers over there refer to as a Baghdad speeding ticket. And so this was apparently a security detail specifically for Negroponte. These were Negroponte's guards. And, you know, that makes sense to me. Negroponte, you know, his philosophy in Central America certainly was, you know, it's better to beg for forgiveness than ask for permission, right? Shoot first, ask questions later. Kill them if you have any concerns at all. And so his special security detail was on the road, and that's who shot up the Italians. And this is going to be a very interesting story to follow over the next 24, 48 hours as this comes out. And to see what if any of this sticks to Negroponte. Of course, I'm predicting none of it will. They'll figure out some way to blame it on some cavalryman from the 3rd Infantry Division or something. It's just a corporal. That's who it was. That's it, you know, and we'll put him in jail. It's a, you know, like the kids at Abu Ghraib who were, and don't get me started. So anyway, it's the George Bush's mess. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain. the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Thanks for being with us today. Tune in tomorrow, same time, same place. We will be back. See you here then. In the meantime, be sure and check out my article today on commondreams.org.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.